This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, assembling the skeleton, showing, telling, and cutting out scenes in speculative fiction.
So I think it's only right that we start this episode by saying Happy New Year to everybody!
Yeah, Happy New Year, everyone.
We got to 2021.
We hit the save point.
We did. Now, whether things improve remains to be seen, but we thought we'd start the year with a technical episode, and as is very true to her nature, Jules has managed to put forward an episode so that she can very sneakily talk about structure.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know how sneaky I'm being when I actually put a little note in brackets saying Jules talks about structure.
When she suggested this episode to me, I was like, oh, this is a great episode. This sounds really, really good. You know, I was thinking of all the things that we could cover. And then I was looking at the notes that Jill sent to me, and I just see the word structure, and I'm like, oh, she got me. She got me good. She
pwned. Yes, sorry about that. You'll still probably be able to talk about the things that you want to talk about as well.
Yeah, no, don't worry. I'm
you're hip to my game.
I'm sure it'll be fine. But yes, it did make me laugh.
Yeah. So basically, very simply, this is: what scenes do you put in your book? What scenes do you not put in your book? Or do you summarise? So in a way, it's kind of showing versus telling. But it's obviously a little bit more in depth than that. So this is a slightly more advanced writerly episode.
Yeah. So before we kind of get into the logistics of it, should we just explain what we mean by show, don't tell?
Yes.
So show, don't tell is one of these monikers that is used all the time when people start writing. And it is a mantra that is repeated over and over and over again. And for the most part, it's good advice.
Yeah, in general, because a story that is entirely told is not interesting because there's no fostering of emotional engagement, generally.
No.
However, there are times when you don't need to show things. Like, we'll assume that if you have a human character, at some point they go to the bathroom and that they need to use the toilet. We don't necessarily need you to show us that unless something really important happens when they're using the toilet.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing about show, don't tell is that showing takes time. And so if you have a lot of show in an area, or a lot of show in your writing, it will slow the writing down. It will slow the pace down. Now, that's good in some places, but you also have to be conscious of the fact that you cannot have a single sort of consistent pace throughout, particularly if you want to have exciting moments, scary moments, tense moments, etc. You need to start varying things. So there are moments actually where showing too much can actually make your writing drag a fair amount.
Yeah.
And the show don't tell is, it's not that you're not supposed to tell at all. You are absolutely allowed to tell things. It's basically about avoiding large chunks of exposition, usually all in one spot, and just kind of disconnecting the reader from the writing, ultimately, in a way that, oh, I'm just kind of being told everything and I'm not actually experiencing any of it.
Yeah, definitely. I know that I am a bear for structure. In fact, some people actually call me the structure bear now, which is, I don't know. It's either really cute or really disturbing, and I haven't made up my mind yet which one of those it is, but we'll go on from there. I think I got written up in someone's acknowledgements as the structure bear. So
I love it, because it could be like this really cute little care bear who sort of climbs on to the desk beside you and goes, "Hello, I'm here to help." Or it could be that you're writing, then the door gets ripped off its hinges and in comes bears.
Massive Kodiak type grizzly. It's like he sweeps the laptop off the desk. Scores claws through the walls and all sorts. Yeah. So yeah. It really, apparently that's my Jekyll and Hyde nature. It's overstructure. Okay. Yeah. The thing with structure, and yes, I've got a big thing about it because it is it's going to be my favourite thing probably forever, but if it's done well, then you don't even notice that there's a structure if you're a reader or if you're watching a film. If it's done badly, you will know there is something wrong with that book or that film. You won't necessarily know what, but you will definitely know there's something wrong.
Yeah, it will feel wrong. And that's the thing I think about readers, is they don't necessarily know all the technical know-how, but they'll know when something's wrong. Just like someone who drives in a car doesn't necessarily know all the bits and bobs and how the car works, but they'll start to figure out very quickly that the car isn't running right if something is wrong.
Definitely. So there are two big things that, you know, authors have problems with, and one of them is, what scenes do I include? And everyone, absolutely everyone who writes, is at some point at least tempted to include a scene that, just because they like it, not because it actually does anything. So we'll get to that a bit later, because we need to do the skeleton first.
Yes.
The other problem is that many authors write books and don't realise that they haven't given the book a spine. And I don't literally mean a spine as in the binding. They haven't given the story a spine. It has no backbone. It has no through line. So what I mean by a through line is basically the one central story arc from a beginning to an end that runs through a story. And that must be there. It must be a core, and it must be the thing that runs from beginning to end in a book.
Yes.
You can have all sorts of character arcs and subplots and whatever else you like. It doesn't have to be a fully linear plot. But you must have a through line, because if you don't, your story is directionless.
Yes. And again, I think the problem with the through line is that because there's so many different forms of storytelling, and there's so many different forms of, you know, media content, people who are writing can start to sort of get mixed up about how they actually create a through line, particularly if you get a lot of your inspiration and you're informed a lot in terms of story structure by television series or things like that. The way that they do a through line is going to be very different to the way that a through line is used in a book or even in a trilogy, etc. And there's going to be sort of several layers there. It's going to be a little bit more complicated. And I think what happens is that people sort of allow themselves to kind of go, oh, well, they do it like this and this, and therefore I can do it like that in my book. And it doesn't work like that. When you have, you know, a page one that goes up to page, let's say, 200 or something like that, and then it's meant to be the end, you need to have a satisfactory journey in some form or another. Even if the story itself isn't quite finished, there does need to be a through line from start to finish. And it needs to be a strong one.
Yeah, absolutely. So trying to think of a good example of a through line. I'll tell you what, I'll pick on my own work rather than someone else's. But if you've read I Belong to the Earth, you start off from the position of M being very closed off and not wanting to accept help from anyone.
Yeah.
And she ends the book by being willing to let everybody in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can extend that to say that that's a struggle for her all the way through the rest of the series. It's something that she keeps falling back on and then having to redevelop again.
Yeah.
So it's baby steps, two steps forward, one step back, all the way through the series. So there is a through line there. There is also a through line in the sense of the actual story content, where you're introduced to the villain on the I think, the third or fourth page, in the form of a cold spot on the stairs. And then you find out who the real villain is at the end of the book. So you get your inciting incident, the cold spot, and you get your climatic exchange at the very end of the book, where that gets resolved. That's a through line. So, yes, lots of other shit happens all around the edges, and there's creepy bits, and other characters have their arcs and are doing weird things, and there's a romantic subplot, but ultimately you're going from there's something creepy in the house to vanquishing the something creepy in the house.
Yeah. And it's the same in The Sons of Thestion. The through line in The Sons of Thestion is very much an internal one, but it's ultimately based on there is something rotten going on in the city, in Hamartia, in the state of it, and there's this precipice of something is about to happen, and it's going to go one way or the other. That's the whole premise, and it's about a character. It's about characters who are trying to run away, ultimately. That is, Yonathan is physically trying to run away, Rufus is emotionally trying to run away, and the story ends with them turning around to face the truth, face their responsibilities, face their emotions. Rufus doesn't want to engage with all the things which are happening because he doesn't really want to accept that there's some really nasty stuff happening in the city. He doesn't want to deal with it. Yonatan just wants to run away, and then by the end, obviously, he makes a deliberate choice to return, and Rufus makes a deliberate choice to learn the truth, accept the truth, and then actually become part of this revolution, which is brewing. So that is the through line of the first book. It's not the through line of the whole series, though.
No. Although, I mean, we'll talk about series in just a moment, but I think you can say that there are definitely echoes of the original through line throughout the series as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, from what I've read.
No, you're absolutely right. Ultimately, there are big themes which carry over. But it's an example of there being a very specific through line in book one.
Yeah.
Which does feed into the next book, obviously, because it's a continuation of their development as characters. But it's, this was the through line for book number one.
So, as we've said, basically, a single book must have a through line. Yeah. The series may well have a through line as well, but each individual episode, and it, you know, if your series is 15 books long, each book has to have its own through line.
Mm-hmm.
And the series may well have one in addition to that. So what I'm writing at the moment, again, it's I was thinking, oh God, I'm talking about this. Have I actually put in a through line? I have put in a through line because you've got the situation, ultimately, the through line in book one and the through line of the series are two different things, certainly in that episode, and it varies depending on how much the series through line is needed to be brought in. But certainly in the first book, Amy's struggling with a sudden increase in her powers at the beginning, and towards the end, she's using those abilities to resolve the plot, basically.
Yeah.
So there you go, through line. Series through line. You've got a team of cryptozoologists who are investigating strange creatures, and they find themselves pitted against Evergreen Technologies who actually want to use these creatures and other things for their own ends.
Which, there's no way that could ever go wrong.
So, without giving away what happens in the very last book, it's a case of, you start off with that being an issue in book one, and by the end of book whatever, which I refuse to admit right now, that is something that will definitely get addressed. So, through lines are really, really important. They are the spinal cord of your story, and your story will not move without them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you know that your through line is weak or absent? There's a few little clues. You don't know how to start or end the story. And I don't mean in a first draft stage, I mean you get onto the second, third, fourth draft, and you're still not sure you've started in the right place, and you still don't have a conclusive ending.
Yeah. It's worth pointing out that obviously there are different ways that you can structure a story. Now, your characters might be different by the end. You might have, you know, a Bilden's Roman, or you might, you know, have an A to B plot where character starts in position A and they end physically, emotionally, etc. in position B. So they've grown. So Frodo, Lord of the Rings, good example, starts in position A and he's definitely a different person by the end of the series. So you could have that. You might then have a tragic sort of plot where someone starts in position A, starts to go onto their journey, and then never quite crosses the threshold, and they end up back in exactly the same position that they started in. You know, they've refused to develop, they've refused to change. There is still going to be a through line within that.
Yeah.
It's not that it's absent. Now, the first one, the A to B, is much more popular in books, and you tend to see it everywhere. Even if it's not a good place that they end up, even if it's a sad, you know, story, they tend to have changed. And I think what happens is that sometimes when people are writing stories, they don't consider the fact that all of this needs to be linked, that the person they become is not possible without considering the person that they were. And therefore, the journey that is required for that change to occur. And that is what the through line carries. It is that fundamental aspect. And I think a lot of people overlook it.
Yeah, definitely. So there's one clue. You don't know how to start or end the story. The opening conflict, as we've said, should match the climactic conflict. So the problem that is introduced at the very beginning should be the problem that is being addressed at the end of the book. And yes, it will have shaped, changed and developed and gone on little journeys and things and perhaps become a bigger problem. But ultimately, you're dealing with the same issue within the character themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Other clues, as this is, you know, this isn't us accusing anybody because we've all been subject to these things, but you suddenly realise a side character has a more compelling problem than the MC.
Yes!
You realise that the MC is actually not your favourite character. Now, if you're the writer, the most compelling character for you should be your main character. And if it's not, then perhaps you've got the wrong main character.
Yes. Which is definitely a problem I've had. Not gonna lie.
Yeah. Well, same.
It's a problem that a lot of people have had, yeah. Where you suddenly go, oh no!
I can't make this series work. Why? Because I've got this great character, but it won't work around her. Oh, that's right. It's because the main character needs to be a completely different person. Yeah, definitely done that. The side character has a more important role in the final showdown. The thing is, your final showdown of both a book and a series, it's not that your main character can't have help or can't have developed and learned how to utilise everybody's strengths to best advantage. But the person who really runs the showdown, the full, you know, main boss battle, needs to be your main character.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I was just going to say that also when we talk about the main boss battle, again, that needn't be, they needn't be therefore the strongest person, you know, physically strong. They needn't be the one who's taking down the whole, you know. It's the main boss battle is the biggest aspect, you know.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
It's the most, you know, it's Luke Skywalker facing Darth Vader. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, a good example of both how to do it and how not to do it, weirdly, is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because you know, you've got, they start off with a basic creature of the week type format, and then as the series go on and they were allowed more space to develop more, you got more of a series arc through each series. So you had the big bad coming at the very end of each one. And with the exception of season 6, Buffy is the one who takes down the big bad at the end of each one. And she does it in varying different ways. She gradually lets more and more people be around her and help. By season 4, it's her with the combined abilities of Willow, Xander and Giles as well, where they do a spell to combine themselves to make a sort of super slayer, because otherwise cyborg demon Adam is kind of like too strong for one slayer by herself. By the end of the 7th season, she's got an entire army of slayers, and everybody is doing their part. So, you know, the entire theme is about power and learning when to let it go and to share it with people. Mm-hmm. Exception, in some ways, is the end of season 6. Willow was the big bad in season 6, and Buffy doesn't solve that one. Buffy is relegated to the side, where she ends up fighting zombie creatures in the bottom of a grave with her sister, resolving that character arc, while it's actually Xander who is the one who solves the big bad. And in some ways that really fit, and in some ways it was a really unsatisfying ending, because we've been primed through that entire season for Buffy to finally get her feet in the game and say, I am alive, I'm here, I'm back from the dead, and you know what, I can do a bit more. And it doesn't really quite come off.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good example. And again, it's not necessarily about physical strength. It can also be, you know, the big emotional showdown. It makes me think of Labyrinth, for example.
Yeah.
You know, that they have this huge battle outside the city. I say this huge battle, you know, there's rocks and stuff everywhere and goblins and whatnot. And the big, you know, the big battle isn't a battle, it's a conversation. It's a battle of the wills instead.
Yeah.
So, because ultimately, at the end of the day, the byline is basically the story of your main character. Now, you can have a byline which covers...
You mean a through line?
Sorry, not byline, through line. The through line is the story of your main character. And you can have a through line which covers more than one character. So again, in The Sons of Thestian, the through line was actually meant to be for both Jonathan and Rufus, because their stories paralleled each other, just like Rufus and Zachary's stories in book 2 parallel each other. So the through line works for them both in that regard.
Yeah, or Game of Thrones, where you've got squillions of characters, but the actual through line is everybody schemes and scrambles and fights over a throne while a real threat comes down from the north, kind of thing. Everyone's ignoring their responsibilities in order to gain power.
Yeah, except for Jon Snow. Guys, please! Seems to be the only one who doesn't want any. So you can have multiple characters all for one through line, but ultimately the through line needs to be at the heart of your main character's story. It is that without it, they don't have a story, ultimately.
Yeah, definitely. So, you've got the spine. Now you need to add a few other bones to that skeleton before you can start putting some meat on it. So, other things you need arcs and child arcs. Now, obviously you've got your through line, which is your big, the main story, your beginning to end. Everything else is kind of gravy around the edge of that. Mm. That was an unfortunate use of gravy when I've been talking about bones, isn't it? Anyway.
You know, I didn't think of that, but thank you for pointing it out to me. It's made my life so much more different.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Most of the other characters who have a part to play will have their own arcs. Now, within an arc, you will also have child arcs. Let's explain what I mean by that. Let's take my great-great-grandmother Quinn, who was a tiny woman, but raised the finest pigs in all of Tipperary. Let's say that she was setting off one day to buy a pig from market. She had money, and she got tired walking all that way because there were no cars back then. Nobody had a cart to give her a ride on. So she stopped under a tree and decided that she'd take her shoes off for a bit. She put her bag down, and when she looked around, her purse had been stolen. There you go, that's the beginning of a child arc.
Right.
So your big problem at the beginning is my great-great-great-grandmother wanted to go and buy a pig, so she sets off to do it. That's the problem. That hasn't been resolved yet. Child arc starts halfway through. Her money gets stolen on the way. So before she can even begin to resolve the main arc there, she has got to find a way of getting the money back. So that's your problem. You then need a turning point where she finds perhaps sees somebody buying beer who doesn't really have two pennies to rub together and knows it's them. So that's the turning point. She's worked out who has the money. And then the resolution might be, knowing my family and the tiny Irish women of my family, she would have just gone over there and probably kicked him in the balls. Or given him a piece of her mind, something which the tiny Irish women of my family are also very well known for.
Really? That's shocking.
I know, I thought it would be. So she gets that back. There you go. That's the resolution of the child arc. So a child arc can sprout up at any time, really, from a main character arc.
Yes. And I think the important thing to do is a child arc is sort of like a tree branch. It goes off on its own. It has its own resolution, you know, it finishes and leaves or whatever. But it's still attached to the through line. It's not just completely divorced. It's not a separate entity.
No, it's not random.
By any stretch of the imagination.
I mean, if my main point is that great-great-granny Quinn had to go and buy a pig and she loses her money on the way, and then I suddenly go, and she decided to just give up and go and join the circus. That's not a child arc. That's a completely different story.
Yeah. We start to... Unless secretly she was going out to buy a pig and dreaming about joining the circus or something like that, at which point it's a different story. But yeah, absolutely. So you can have these small little child arcs. And in fact, to be honest, in a lot of cases where you have, you know, the growing complications or stuff like that, you do have a little bit of a child arc, because it might be like, okay, in order to reach the city where we need to go and see this man about a dog, I don't know, we have to cross this river. We have to cross this lake. But to cross this lake, we will need to help the ferryman find his daughter first, or something along those lines, where a task must be completed in order to do sort of the next bit, and it's part of the complication. You can have child arcs there, you can have child arcs with your side characters, etc. as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is a classic component, without going off on too much of a tangent, of fairy tales and things. So you've got your younger son who sets out in the world to make his fortune. He is about a princess beset by a dragon, wants to rescue her, but finds he doesn't have the money to get to where he needs to go. And, you know, it's the classic rule of three thing whereby he ends up acquiring, I don't know, a giant bodyguard, a magical harp that can lull things to sleep, you know, through acts of kindness and things on the way. Go and have a look at, not you personally, Madeline, I'm aware you've already done it, but go and have a look at sort of basic fairy tales, and you'll find this structure over and over and over again, and it's because it's a successful structure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you have arcs and child arcs. You also need characters with enough agency to affect your through line.
Yes. A through line is like a road. But you do actually have to have characters who can walk on it. They have to have their own sort of agency. It gets very, very boring if a through line is literally just a... What are they called? You know, one of these moving...
Oh, look, a conveyor belt.
Yeah, like a conveyor belt. If it's just a conveyor belt, they just sit there and watch the world go past. Because then actually they're not really getting anywhere, are they? Not really. No. They do need to have agency in order to sort of walk this path.
Yeah, definitely. I realise I'm talking arcs within arcs here, and we talked about arcs, child arcs. Character arcs should also have their own character arcs. So this is kind of separate. This is the character's internal journey. So we'll go back to my aunt who was raising pigs. Maybe her internal journey was that she didn't actually want to raise pigs anymore. She wanted to move up and start raising herds of cows, but she needed enough money. Yeah. Therefore, she needed to make her pig business really successful.
Yeah.
Just for reference, by the way, my great-great-great-grandmother did in fact raise pigs in Tipperary and was very well known for it. She also ran an apothecary service. So there you go.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me in the least.
No, my lot have always been into sort of healing type stuff for some reason. Can't think why. Okay, so you would also need relationship arcs to those characters, because how we interact with each other is really important. How the relationship you have with your parents, whether they're there, whether they're absent, whether you like them, whether you don't, whether you get on, that's important early information. And it's the same for everyone else, particularly if you're going to have a dual narrative. How do your two main characters get on with each other? How do the adventurers in the merry band that will form around your main character, how do they all interact with each other?
Yeah. And of course, these are all going to feed into the through line as well.
Yeah.
It's all part of the same tree.
It's all part of the same tree. Yeah, you're not growing an orchard here.
I love that you're not growing an orchard. You might be, but only one story per tree, people, please.
You also need significant subplots. Assuming you were writing something that has subplots. I've seen a slight trend in young adult fiction lately where you get a linear story and very little in the way of subplot. I personally don't find that very satisfying. However, I have been in reading groups reading these books with people who have then gone, oh, that was brilliant. I was really glad I didn't get distracted. And it really worked for them. So, you know, that's kind of a personal thing. But I would say you definitely need at least one or two supporting subplots. And they should support. They shouldn't be divorced from the through line. They should be supporting that main arc and then resolving either just before the end or just after.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I also think it's important because it actually diversifies your reader group a tiny bit.
Yeah.
It gives you the opportunity to also experiment with certain things which might be a little bit risky if you move them into the main characters instead. So the side plots, the side arcs and things like that have actually, you know, historically been a great place for diversity, for opportunity to explore some more intense kind of things which you can't look at, you know, as the main focus because of X, Y, and Z. I'm not going to go into that whole thing.
Nope.
but it provides that opportunity. And it also actually means that as a reader, if I'm looking at it and going, okay, this sort of main romance is a tiny bit vanilla, fine, I can sort of follow on with it. But by God, every time this character appears on screen and they're off doing their own little thing, I get super excited. You know, it can actually sell your story even more, because even if the main characters are your favourite characters, providing other opportunities and satisfying stories for other characters who aren't just there to prop up the main characters can be very, very good.
Definitely.
And I'm not gonna name A Court of Thorns and Roses, but I did just name A Court of Thorns and Roses.
You read my mind.
I could feel it.
I was sat here thinking about A Court of Silver Flames, and you know what, I'm gonna do it to myself because I have to know, but I'm also really braced for it going horribly wrong. Anyway, moving back to our little list of bones that we need to add, all these things, the through line arcs, child arcs, characters with enough agency, character arcs, relationship arcs, and significant subplots, they should all be at some point introduced in the first third of your book. This is the rule of thirds. So you don't, for example, introduce a major, major character in the last third of your book.
Unless they don't start off being a major character and you're actually writing a series.
Then I would argue that they're not a major character in that book. They might become a major character in the series.
Yes.
But true. They're not a major character in that book.
Yeah, I'm being very pedantic. But no, Jules is absolutely right that if you want someone who's going to be a big, you know, mover and shaker within your story, sort of adding them in the last in the last third is very unsatisfying.
There are obviously exceptions to this rule, and I'm not sure they're terribly successful exceptions. Like, for example, Charles Dickens's Little Dorrit. You don't actually meet Little Dorrit until we're about 150 pages in. He mentions her a few times, but there's an awful lot of scene setting, and I think he was really trying to work his way into that story, and because obviously it was serialized, it's kind of once it's out there kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
I mean, does Aslan count? I mean, because the thing is, Aslan may not physically be present the whole way throughout the book, but he's talked about a lot.
Yeah, but he's also not a main character. The main characters are the children and a few of the magical creatures. Aslan's never a main character.
Yeah, but I mean, he still has a whole, that whole kind of being sacrificed sort of scene and then coming back as the sort of the saviour and stuff like that.
And you could argue that perhaps that means that the through line of Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is not terribly successful, except that the children very much do follow a through line that is slightly different, and that does deliver successfully. But yeah, he's not really a main character. You can boil things down with statistics, and I don't want to make reading boring for people or watching films boring, but I swear, if you're watching something and you think, oh, well, that's obviously the main character because that's the one I associate with most or the one I resonate with most. If you then work out how many minutes on screen they are and compare it to various other characters, you'll see exactly how important that character is.
Yeah.
And it's the same with books.
So,
yeah, pick a book that you don't like very much and do that, maybe, because I don't want to ruin anything you really like, but it's a useful exercise to try.
But it's also, I mean, it's like, who's the main character in Sleeping Beauty?
Well, that is the question.
Because it's not Aurora.
It isn't. Well, that follows the classic fairy tale format of the prince is actually kind of, you know, the one who is the main character. It's just, it's been changed over the years because you were selling it to little girls and they wanted to hear about princesses, not princes. Basically, that little shopping list of things that you must include should appear at some point during the first third of your novel. And if you can combine them so they turn up a few of them together in different scenes so that you can see the connections between all these things, then that's also very useful. The one exception, I would say, is the villain. You might not actually introduce the villain until the very end of a book.
I know exactly what you mean, and I agree, but I do think that even if you don't introduce the actual villain, their shadow needs to be present in some form.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether it's just the general kind of influence that they've had, and that actually kind of needs to be present from the beginning, even if it is only just a shadow in some form or another. So, for instance, let's say you had the story about a young kid whose village gets destroyed by soldiers. The villain could be the king himself, who's created this corrupt system and has allowed these evil deeds to happen. The king himself might not appear until right the end of the story, but his influence is felt early on.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously completely agree with that, just in terms of not introducing them as an actual person. You can definitely get away with not having the villain on page one, or you can have them on page one in a completely different form. See, again, I belong to the earth, a cold spot on the stairs with no actual personality attached to it that we know of. Okay, so here we go, we have a skeleton. So, the next question is, how do you choose what to put on the skeleton so that you get a lean, mean beast that's actually going to run and take your reader somewhere?
Yeah. See, Jules, I keep forgetting that we're going with the skeleton analogy. and I just forget just in time for you to go, now we have a skeleton. And I'm like, wait, what's happening? What? We've got a what?
The trouble is, you know me well enough to know that if I say we've got a skeleton, I might mean it literally.
You might mean it literally. I mean, like, literally we do have at least one skeleton between us. Hopefully more than one, unless you're missing some bones, Jules.
Not that I'm aware of. I don't have an exoskeleton either. Despite what exes might say.
Do you not? This is so surprising. I take mine off every Sunday to be cleaned. Sorry, small tangent then. So we have a skeleton. Now it's time to do a Victor Frankenstein and to add some meat to the bones.
Yes. Ideally, we'll do it slightly better than Victor Frankenstein so that we won't go, ah, when we actually see the final result.
That's because he was weak. But anyway, let's do better than Frankenstein with his weak constitution.
Yeah.
This
is basically...
Where do we start?
Yeah, this is basically what scenes would you add, what scenes would you leave out, and what would you summarise? How do you know which ones you'd use in which capacity? So we'll talk some general things about scenes and we'll see how we go. So a scene should accomplish three things. It should further the main arc, so your through line, and possibly the character arc as well, if it's appropriate at that point. Mm-hmm. It should tell you something about the characters involved in that scene, and it should make you ask what next, so you should then want to read on. And we've talked about the trick and the art and how you can draw your reader on after you, so you can check out that podcast if you want a bit of a recap on that. But basically, a scene should do those three things. If it isn't doing those three things, that scene is not pulling its weight.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the problem is that sometimes a scene can be doing that. Sometimes you can have a scene which is just about developing character, which is also then kind of links in with the through line, because the through line isn't just about the physical journey. It can be just as much about the emotional journey. So the development of character, the development of relationships within that, these can be core aspects. But you can have a scene which is doing all of those things and still isn't right because it hasn't actually furthered the plot, or it's actually causing the atmosphere to drag, or it's in the wrong place, or ultimately, even though it has sort of, you know, developed the characters a tiny bit in some way, it's not significant enough to warrant staying.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, at its baseline, it should do those three things. But sometimes even if it does those three things, as Madeline said, it's not necessarily adding anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
At which point what you do is you copy and you save that scene in a separate document and you send it to your friends so that they can read it.
Well, you might do. You might save it for later. Yeah, I mean, don't just delete it. Take it out, but hold on to it. It might turn up in another book.
Yes.
It might get adapted. You know, so there's all sorts of things you can do with... It might turn out that you actually need it later in the book. Mm. Okay, you should probably not create a scene just to introduce a minor character.
Yes. Now, I think this is one of those things where you have a character, you're like, oh gosh, I really want to introduce that, or I want to make a reference. And sometimes I'm guilty of it, don't get me wrong. I'm totally guilty of it, where I will just add something a little bit so that I can put a reference in there somewhere, or so that I can just put a reference to another character, or I can just briefly have another character in. I am totally guilty of that. You shouldn't do it too much. You really shouldn't make a big thing of it. In fact, you really shouldn't do it at all.
No,
specifically to just add a kind of a minor character who doesn't really provide anything for the plot or the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine to add a minor character as long as they're doing something, but having a whole scene just to introduce that minor character is pointless. That's just going to drag your plot. Instead, have a scene with the main character and introduce the minor character by having them interact with your main character.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things, and the killing your darlings thing, it's very real. But again, I hate the word kill, because it just makes it sound like, no, you just have to cut it off and then pretend it never happened. You don't. You can really like something and it can still not be good for your book, at which point you just copy and paste it out onto another document, which you save for later.
And possibly send to your friends, you never know.
And possibly send to your friends.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's the main character's narrative. And it's not that you can't have scenes and things that happen with your main character not in them. You absolutely can, depending on what point of view you're using. But they should be furthering or conflicting with the main character's goals. And they should definitely be linked to your through line. If you're, this is an interesting one, really. If you're delaying introducing the main protagonist, you should have mentioned them a few times on page. So as Madeline was saying with the villain, you should be able to feel the shadow even if you don't have a name for the villain. The protagonist, yes. You should probably have a name. So let's say you were writing a book about Robin Hood or a Robin Hood type character, but it's not from that a Robin Hood character perspective. It's from a Maid Marian perspective, and she's in financial trouble or her family is, and basically
being blackmailed by the sheriff.
Yeah, whatever, something like that. And the whole thing to get out of it, she's got the option of, you know, you must act as bait for this Robin Hood type character. So you'd have mentioned the main character or one of the main characters. You just wouldn't have had him appear on the page, kind of thing.
Yes.
And you can even have a fairly long introduction of, you know, scene setting and stuff, which is fairly important. I think Jennifer Fallon does it in the Immortal Prince, where you don't actually meet the Immortal Prince until he turns up for his own hanging sometime later.
Oh, that's fun.
But the Immortals are kind of mentioned and you're sort of gradually seeded into the story. I think there are other books that do it even better. But yeah. Basically you should mention the main character.
Yeah.
Don't just introduce them a third of the way through. It's like, haha, surprise, it's their story.
Yeah. Again, things like Game of Thrones, you know, the first scene of book one, Game of Thrones, just has these characters you meet very briefly right at the start who are getting chased by White Walkers. And then they all die by sort of chapter two. The last surviving one gets beheaded. But the last surviving one obviously leads us to Ned Stark, who is arguably the main character of book one. He's at least one of the main driving forces of book one. And this is... So it's not that long until we meet the main character, but straight from the start we have that incredibly important establishment of the through line, which is there are some shenanigans going on in the north, but everyone's more worried about the shenanigans going on in the south.
Yeah, exactly. Another example is Michelle Faber's The Crimson Petal and the White. You go through, I think, the first two chapters where you're just following prostitutes of gradual greater importance until you finally get to Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because it takes you through a tour through Victorian London and what it would be like to be kind of basically what they called a trotter, which is a street prostitute, to one that would work in an actual brothel. And you get introduced to the main male character as well. But yeah, it is a slow beckon through the grimy streets of London. And you've got this third person omniscient narrator who says, well, this isn't the person you're going to be focusing on. That actually literally says, this isn't the person you're going to be focusing on. You haven't met the person who's important enough yet. And it's a really clever way that it sort of draws you through till you finally get the main character. And you're not surprised when you get there, because you've been led to believe that there's something special coming. And I suppose that's the other thing, is if you're delaying introducing your main character, depending on how long you delay it, you need a proportionally big payoff.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think... Okay, so another example of this is The Lies of Loch Lomora.
Yeah.
Where... Jules is so unenthusiastic. But the beginning of The Lies of Loch Lomora, you meet Chains, you meet Father Chains, and you meet the Thief Maker. And the main character of Loch Lomora, oddly enough, is Loch Lomora, who you don't actually meet until later on. Because what you get instead is the Thief Maker coming up and basically saying, I've got this kid. Do you want him? Because otherwise I'm going to kill him. And you meet Loch Lomora through their descriptions, as it were, but you don't actually meet him until later on. But it gives a hell of an impression in terms of sort of a character introduction.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, utilise the expected trend rule. So put it this way, in fact, Lachlan Mora is a good one. Let's take that as the example. Obviously, Lachlan Mora is a con artist and a thief, etc. But you don't see, you don't see from him being a child all the way up through his boyhood every single theft he ever performs. Instead, it sets the expected trend. You learn that he managed to successfully steal from a guard who was capturing him at the time.
Yes.
And then he manages to successfully steal from, I think it's one of the other boys, possibly.
Yeah, no. So it's, yeah, he steals from a guard who's having been sort of trapped, quarantined in a city where all of the adults, sorry, part of the city where all the adults had died and everyone was, you know, dying of hunger, and there was this horror thing. It was basically this awful horror show of death and decay and murder and violence. And the guard sort of picks up this 4-year-old child who immediately steals from him.
Yeah.
Which is a good way of starting out your career. He then steals from an entire bar and burns it to the ground. And then he manages to organise a huge theft so that he gets a very expensive... He gets a lot of money and frames another boy, which accidentally leads to that boy and his mate being murdered.
Yeah.
But we have that sort of... We have those three instances. We don't, you know, it talks about the fact that obviously he's been doing a lot of theft between that. But they name those three instances, which for me really do set up the trend of, first of all, escalation, and increased dramatics and increased craftiness.
Yeah. So the trend is that you have someone who steals, and therefore you've shown him stealing, and yes, okay, you've got a couple more whereby he does progressively larger and larger things, but the important thing is he steals, therefore the audience believes that this person steals, and you don't then get a detailed show of every single theft he ever performs. So that is the expected trend.
Sorry, I'm wheezing again because I'm just thinking about certain assassins who were told are terrible assassins, but we never actually see them kill anyone.
Yes, that is another really good example. If you take Sarah J. Maas's Throne of Glass series, where you have Selena Sardothian is how she starts out. She actually turns out to be a fairy because Sarah J. Maas is obsessed.
On that we can agree.
On that you can agree. No, they're not really good fairies, though. Anyway, moving back. But yeah, you're told she is the best assassin, but you never, ever see her kill anyone. Ever. In fact, you barely see her lift a sword. So it is a case of, yes, you're told this, but it's never backed up by an actual action. So instead of successfully setting an expected trend, it kind of does the reverse.
Yeah.
So yeah, expected trend is great if you set it up properly, and you can then play with it. So what if you had Lachlan Mora, who starts off being a thief, obviously he becomes a con artist, and you can tell that from those three incidents you've talked about. They get gradually more elaborate, and he schemes better, and he makes mistakes and falls down, but he's well into sort of the con by the time you get to the third one.
Yes.
So yeah, that's a good escalation of the expected trend. You've reset the trend. With the third incident in that case, and you kind of go on from there. We know that this is someone who's not going to just sit down and take life as it comes at him. He's going to scheme around it.
Yeah, and this is not someone who's just interested in pickpocketing. This is someone who's interested in theatrics, grand theatrics.
Definitely. So, you know, leading on from that. Basically, don't devote a scene to anything that isn't an important part of an important arc. So it doesn't have to be an important part of the through line necessarily, although it must connect to it. But it needs to be an important part of an arc that actually does affect the through line.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Also need to consider genre expectations. So, I mean, the example I've written down is most paranormal romance would not skip sex scenes. Not all, but most of it wouldn't. Whereas if you have most urban fantasy, yes, you might get a sex scene, but they're probably not going to make it 2 or 3 chapters long, which is definitely something I've seen in paranormal romance. And that's fine. They're both those things are fine because they're genre expectations.
Yeah.
It would be like writing a war novel and not ever showing a battle scene.
Yeah.
Or a planning session.
Yeah, it would be like, it would be kind of like writing a period drama and at no point does anyone go to a dance.
Well, I suppose it depends where you are, doesn't it?
No, I know. That was a joke. That was a joke.
It's like if it's Conrad's Heart of Darkness, then you're probably not going to have a country dance in the middle of that.
Why not?
You're right. It's been misinterpreted.
He's a coward.
All this terrible dark stuff happening in the Congo. They should definitely liven it up with a country dance.
Yeah, just a country dance. Yeah.
Okay.
No way that would be insensitive at all.
So those are things you should think about, like, how you include them. Scenes that you absolutely should include. If you're setting up a problem that is part of a main arc that affects the through line, you need to show that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You should show the turning point of the character realising how to resolve that problem, or at least coming up with an idea to do so. And you should show the resolution. Yeah.
Are my favourite parts of a story.
I know, it's kind the in-betweeny bits. I'm like, oh god, I'm writing in-betweeny bits today, and it's like, I know I'll enjoy it once I get going, but I find it much harder to get myself going on those.
Yeah, and so, like, when I see people skimping out on these main aspects, I'm like, is this really the story that you want to tell? Because it feels like the in-betweeny bits are the ones that you care more about than the actual main plot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously it depends, because if it's a side character and their conflict is less important, or even if it's a main character, say a main character, we'll have a shapeshifting coyote main character who's a private mm-hmm. investigator. She needs to get some information about somebody, and her lead has led her to this underground dance club, which, you know, mm-hmm. is frequented by vampires and shapeshifters, etc. And she goes...
This is very specific, Jules.
No, this is just out of my head. This is what my head is like all the time.
Okay, all right, I like it. Okay, continue.
Okay, so the main conflict there is she needs to get information out of somebody who may not want to give it to her. And mm-hmm. she's got a few ideas how to get around that. Now there's a child arc. She's trying to get into the club, but the bouncer won't let her in. That's a minor conflict. You don't need to report that entire minor conflict. You can just say, oh yeah, the bouncer gave me a hard time until I, you know, pulled my top down and showed a bit more cleavage kind of thing. You know, however it was she got around this guy.
Yeah.
You don't need a scene for that. You just need a, oh god, that bouncer was an asshole kind of throwaway paragraph.
Yeah. Unless it's, you know, her problem with the bouncer is meant to be a big, big thing.
Yeah. In which case you go in the other direction.
Yes.
So this is one of my bugbears, and I have to admit this is something I've done, but not deliberately. It's kind of just happened in one of my historical fictions. And that is, if you introduce a problem, it can't just go away with a wave of the hand. If you introduce a problem and say to your reader, this is the problem for this character, you can't a few pages later, or even a few chapters later, go, and it was resolved off page, because that's cheating your reader.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Particularly if it's one of your main characters.
Yeah. And this is something where, basically, when I was co-writing Oath and Crown with Matt Willis, it was supposed to be one book, and we overshot our word count by something like 250,000 words. So it became two books.
Just a tiny bit.
Just a tiny bit. It became two books. And, you know, it's been a duology that a lot of historical fiction readers have really enjoyed. But there's one part where I look back now and think, I wish I'd been able to give that a little more space. And it's two fairly minor characters who are scheming together. And Alf Giefer actually works out what's going on, and she takes steps to neutralise both of those characters. But those resolutions happen off page, and they're not really major enough that they desperately had to be on page, but they were kind of in the between zone where they could have been.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you live and learn kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other problem is that sometimes people will say, right, you've got to cut some stuff, and so
yeah,
things have to be cut and you have to make sacrifices. But for the most part, try to avoid doing that.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it wasn't more important than the battle at Stamford Bridge, for example, so...
No. Let's just cut the entire battle out.
It's like, we'll report that. We'll have some messenger come back and talk about the Battle of Stamford Bridge, and we'll really focus on this scheming minx who's having an affair with a stable boy. And, okay, final thing, and this is something you should think about for all writing, but look for emotional impact. So if you're someone who's just starting out, or you still find it difficult to work out where your problem, turning point, and resolution moments are, look for the things you're writing that make you really feel something. Because chances are, that's what's...
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately, that's what you want to do with a story. A story of any kind is meant to provoke an emotional response. Be that, you know, fear, love, anger, you know, just investment in general. You want to provoke an emotional response. And if you yourself are not... If you're not able to evoke that response within yourself, then you've got to ask yourself, am I doing that for my readers? So if you're cutting out all the scenes, or you're ignoring scenes where there is going to be a big emotional response, and you find yourself sort of forcing out very dry content instead, you've got to ask yourself, am I doing this the right way around?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so those are scenes that, well... Basically, we couldn't do an exhaustive list of what you should and shouldn't include, but they're basically things that should get you thinking about it, hopefully. So to finish off, we're just going to look at journeys and collapsing time, because this is more stuff that's important when choosing scenes.
See, when you say collapsing time, it just... And now we're going to just look at the steady collapse of time as... It's our universe in clothes.
Yes, yeah, we've moved on from petty necromancy onto multiverse theory. I like to keep things fresh and interesting.
Oh, you always do, don't you? So, I think the first thing to remember is that unless something important happens, so a problem, turning point, or a resolution, or that the journey ultimately is the story. You know, unless it's one of those kinds of things, you're better off just not including it.
Yeah, definitely. Journeys are by and large boring. So unless it's like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the Wheel of Time, which, you know, I'd argue is still boring, even though the journey is the point. But, you know, everyone has their own preference there.
Yeah,
basically, I don't know what my head was on. I was like, yeah, think about if you were explaining how you went to the Chelsea Flower Show and there was a bomb scare. Would you spend half an hour talking about driving and parking the car? So...
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, there are times where the journey is part of the story.
Yeah, if something important happens, definitely show that part of the journey.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, Jason and the Argonauts.
Sorry, because I sent you that the other day, I'm now like giggling every time anyone says Jason and the Argonauts.
You did, yes.
To clarify, I saw a thing on Twitter and went, Madeline will find that really funny. And what I saw was someone saying, what if Jason and the Argonauts was really just a gay cruise that went horribly wrong? And I'm like, that's really funny. I'm sending that to Madeline.
So, you know, on their homoerotic cruise. they're very gay cruise, which is, you know, the point of their journey. Things do keep going wrong, so it is actually, you know, part of the journey. Same with, you know, Ulysses and stuff like that, where the journey is actually a fairly, you know, pinnacle part of what's happening, because they keep being met with all sorts of problems. And then, you know, like Sinbad, the DreamWorks Sinbad, which is great.
Yeah.
Obviously, they, you know, they do show parts of the journey because they've got to get through all of these trials, which are, you know, getting in the physical way of their physical journey.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you can also use flashbacks to collapse time. So you're kind of folding your narrative back on itself. This is something that is really, really handy. I was given a 40,000 word limit for each of the books in the King's Knight series. So when people leave me reviews saying it's too short, I'm really sorry, that's what I was asked to provide. And I still overshot my word limit on pretty much all of them. But the way I managed to get backstory and, you know, keep everything moving and keep everything fairly action-packed in the first book, Revolt, was by doing it in a back-and-forth flashback narrative. Now, the reason that that actually worked was I was still using the same through line. The through line was still disenfranchised knight comes home, discovers his home is in ruins and needs to get to the king in order to take on his title and start fixing things. That's it. Yeah. That's a very simple through line. But the things he had to do in order to go from point A to point B when there's a big revolt happening in the background
just becomes steadily more complicated.
Yeah. So the flashback thing worked really well. If I told it in a linear way, he would have come back, he would have gone into a marriage of convenience, they'd have not got on very well, and he'd have eventually gone off, got robbed on his way to London with his wife's diary, etc. All the way through, the revolt happens, almost burns to death in the house, blah, 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 all the way, finally meets the king. And that would have been longer, because that would have needed more in-betweeny bits. So to condense it into 40,000 words, doing the flashback thing worked really well for me. And also I think it made it a faster paced read. Whereas some people would have started with the whole, you must go into a marriage of convenience, would have been quite bored by that point, perhaps wouldn't have gone any further.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing is that obviously there were things that happened in the past with Gregory, which then kind of reflected some of the things that were happening to him in the present.
Yeah.
And so if you weren't going sort of between flashbacks and stuff like that, instead what would happen is that you'd have the events, then you'd have a whole chunk of story, and then you'd have to kind of be reminded of the events later on in order to have the same impact of, you know, stuff that happens later on. Whereas if two scenes are side by side, you know, you can create that, you can build up atmosphere, tension, etc., even if they are set at two completely different periods of time.
Yeah, there is a sort of paralleling effect. I would love to say that I was clever enough to really plan this out, but I started doing it out of instinct and only worked out what I was doing when I'd already done it. But now I know what I'm doing. I'm like, yeah, I can actually totally do that in the future. That would work.
Yeah.
That said, flashbacks are not something to be used lazily. That it's not a way of you wedging in a big info dump about a character's backstory or anything. It needs to be relevant to the through line that is happening at that time.
Yes, and the other thing about flashbacks is that they do break concentration. They can kind of, because just like every time you break, you know, you break into a new chapter, a new section, there's a moment of pause where you kind of, it's like an advert break.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to have, if you're building something up and then you keep going back to a flashback, it's like stopping and starting over and over and over again. And it can actually really distance your reader from the story. It can actually make things feel jolting and difficult to follow, which you don't want. And as Jules was saying, you don't ever really want an info dump. You've got to ask yourself, do I need this flashback? Is it, you know, do I need this flashback in order to introduce this one particular character who I could have just mentioned briefly in one paragraph? Do we need this flashback of him, you know, churning butter? Or can we just say that he churned butter?
Yeah.
Oh, but do we need this flashback of him watching his father die? Probably. It sounds like it might be important, you know, etc.
Yeah. And if you're not sure, basically, if a flashback reveals something about an MC's past, then it's something that should feed into the main problem that gets resolved at the end of the book.
Yeah.
So like in Gregory's case, it's kind of like, don't want to make a connection with anybody. And towards the end of the book, yeah, he's kind of like, I do nothing for nobody. I care about no one. And all through the book, he just adopts people.
I care about no one except this small child and this annoying poet and this waspish woman and this young king and this
but everybody else can go
knight
to hell.
And, the-
and by the end of the book, he's kind of like, he's questioning a lot of those preconceptions that he'd had from not being terribly happy as a boy himself. So
yeah.
Yeah. Other things to consider. Well, it depends again on genre, but beware of battle fatigue or action fatigue.
Yeah, and I think this is the other thing, is that we are kind of spoilt very much in the way that TV works, and that you do have a lot of action scenes. And even on TV, even when you have those amazing visuals, having too much of that starts to get very boring.
Yeah, it does. And I'll admit that, you know, I love a really good battle scene, but there's got to be a lot of character stuff going on there. Otherwise, you will not keep my interest.
Yeah.
Because I'm not there just for the fighting. I know people are not going to believe me if they hear that, but I'm not there just for the fighting. I'm there for the really... it's got to hit me on several levels. And it's definitely the same in books. This is not having a pop at Jim Butcher particularly, because I've spoken to other people who've really, really enjoyed both Changes and Battleground, where one of the problems for me is that it is wall-to-wall action in both of them, and everything blurs together, and I'm just kind of like, well, I started skim reading because I got bored. I wanted to skim read through until I got to a character interaction that I found interesting. Some people really enjoyed it, but still, having said that, those people still said that was too much action in one go.
Yeah.
You needed breathing. This was kind of like, you've worked out how to play a C major chord and you are slamming your hands down on the keys for all your worth, but you're not varying it with anything.
Yeah. Also, C major is not that interesting as a chord. I mean, it's a good...
I think it's fascinating if you don't know any other chords, but if you actually know lots of other chords, it's kind of like, C major, basic, you know?
The first chord you learn. Yeah. But yes, no, I know exactly what you mean. To be honest, I find it really, really difficult to read a lot of action and fight scenes in books. I just have always found it very difficult. And the thing that I'm more interested in is the emotional... you know, fallback of these kinds of scenes or things along those lines.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I'm probably gonna struggle with the next Jim Butcher books, which is probably why I haven't picked them up, along with many other reasons.
I think you really like
anyway,
Peace Talks.
Yeah. I will read them at some point. I've got a huge pile of stuff that I need to get through.
I'm not helping there, am I?
No, you're not, because every time I'm like, oh, I could do some reading, and then Jules is like, hey, I've written a book. Well, great. Send it on over. Yeah.
Okay. So, just to wrap things up then, really, basically, if scenes don't pull their weight, leave them out, or summarise them.
Yeah. If it just doesn't do what it needs to do, get rid of it. It's as simple as that. And when we say get rid of it, again, copy paste it, put it somewhere else, send it to a friend, they might want it. But you've got to be a little bit ruthless with your books.
Yeah, definitely. So
I remember, sorry, just as a just as a little aside, Kestrel book one. Now, Jules, you might not even remember this. There was a scene in Kestrel Book 1 where Kestrel goes into a little, like, a petrol station, and she gets attacked by a poltergeist. And
no,
there's this just this whole scene.
I remember you talking about that, but I don't think I ever got the copy of the book with that scene still in it.
Yeah, well, yeah, she fights off this poltergeist which is actually a poltergeist she had already defeated once, because it was the one that used to haunt her home before she moved in. And this poltergeist tries to kill her again, and she gets rid of it. And it was this whole joke that she left Galahad in the car, and she comes back into the car, like, there's glass in her hair and everything. Galahad's like, what? And she's like, you're never leaving my side again. Close the car door. And I loved writing that scene. It was so much fun. It didn't add anything. It was just literally this small caveat where something small happens, and it wasn't necessary for what I actually needed in the story itself. Just like there was another scene at one point where she almost gets hit by a train. Again, great fun to write. It didn't add anything to the through line. So I had to get rid of it. But you know what? There'll be another time. There will be other times when I can almost have Kestrel hit by a train, and there'll be other times when she'll get attacked by poltergeists. They're just sitting, waiting for their opportunity.
Definitely. And failing that, you can have outtakes on your website, because once you've got a fan base, they love reading things like that.
Yes, they do. Like me, who gets all of Jules's outtakes. I say all of them.
I think mostly you haven't had the alternate ending to I Rule the Night.
Don't you dare.
But I'm not going to give you that yet, because I'm already tormenting you with something else in Harker and Blackthorn, and I think it's too much to ask of any friendship to do both of those.
Don't touch me, it hurts too much. I don't trust you. Anyway. So there we go. That is our advice about sort of showing in terms of plot rather than telling, and what you tell and what you show, and how you build up a plot and a through line which is going to be satisfying and enjoyable.
Yeah. So obviously, if you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you.
Yes.
You can contact us via the Dissecting Dragon site on Podbean or on Facebook. We're on Twitter. And we are both on Tumblr, although you're more likely to get Madeline on there than me, in fairness.
Yes. Please do get in touch with us. We love hearing from you. And before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And for the first recommendation of 2021, I'm actually going to recommend a non-fiction documentary.
Ooh.
I know, this is very rare for me, even though I do love documentaries. So this is actually a 2019 documentary series, I believe, which is on Netflix, and it's called Revolutions: The Ideas That Changed the World. Now, I'm going to be honest, I've only seen one episode so far, and it was basically about space travel and sort of the accumulation of ideas and knowledge and concepts, which have led us to be able to leave this planet. And I just thought it was brilliant. It wasn't condescending in the way that some documentaries can be, and it took a really great wide view of how these ideas have been culminated, not just in recent history, but across history, right from sort of the early ages of the creation of fireworks, which kind of led to the ideas of propulsion, etc. It's really, really nicely done. They've got like a nice mix of experts who come in and speak about it. The pacing is great. It's very interesting. It really is. So I highly recommend it for anyone who just wants to watch something a tiny bit nerdy, and who's just interested in technology. And I think the thing I liked the most about it was that it was optimistic. It was hopeful. It looked at some of the nasty things in history, but came out with this look at the possibilities of the future with this technology. Look at what could be achieved. And I think that we could all do with a little bit of optimism and possibility.
Definitely. That sounds really interesting, and it's definitely up my street.
Excellent. For now, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Happy New Year, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.